time dusk fell, her handmaids would need to help her down from her mount. Even the knights brought no relief. Khal Drogo ignored her when they rode, even as he had ignored her during their wedding, and spent the evenings drinking with his warriors and blood riders, racing his prized horses, watching women dance and men die. Danny had no place in these parts of his life. She was left to sup alone, or with Ser Jorah and her brother, and afterwards to cry herself to sleep. Yet every night, some time before dawn, Drogo would come to her tent and wake her in the dark, to ride her as relentlessly as he rode his stallion. He always took her from behind, Dothraki fashion, for which Danny was grateful. That way, her lord husband could not see the tears that wet her face, and she could use her pillow to muffle her cries of pain. When he was done, he would close his eyes and begin to snore softly, and Danny would lie beside him, her body bruised and sore, hurting too much for sleep. Day followed day, and night followed night, until Danny knew she could not endure a moment longer. She would kill herself rather than go on, she decided one night. Yet when she slept that night, she dreamt the dragon dream again. Viserys was not in it this time. There was only her and the dragon. Its scales were black as night, wet and slick with blood. Her blood, Danny sensed. Its eyes were pools of molten magma, and when it opened its mouth, the flame came roaring out in a hot jet. She could hear it singing to her. She opened her arms to the fire, embraced it, let it swallow her whole, let it cleanse her and temper her and scar her clean. She could feel her flesh sear and blacken and slough away. She could feel her blood boil and turn to steam. And yet there was no pain. She felt strong and new and fierce. And the next day, strangely, she did not seem to hurt quite so much. It was as if the gods had heard her and taken pity. Even her handmaids noticed the change. "Khaleesi," Jiqui said, "what is wrong? Are you sick?" "I was," she answered, standing over the dragon's eggs that Illyrio had given her when she wed. She touched one, the largest of the three, running her hand lightly over the shell. "Black and scarlet," she thought, "like the dragon in my dream." The stone felt strangely warm beneath her fingers. Or was she still dreaming? She pulled her hand back nervously. From that hour onward, each day was easier than the one before it. Her legs grew stronger, her blisters burst, and her hands grew calloused. Her soft thighs toughened, supple as leather. The Carl had commanded the handmaid Iri to teach Danny to ride in a Dothraki fashion. But it was the filly who was a real teacher. The horse seemed to know her moods as if they shared a single mind. With every passing day, Danny felt surer in her seat. The Dothraki were a hard and unsentimental people, and it was not their custom to name their animals. So Danny thought of her only as the Silver. She had never loved anything so much. As the riding became less an ordeal, Danny began to notice the beauties of the land around her. She rode at the head of the Khalasar with Drogo and his blood riders, so she came to each country fresh and unspoiled. Behind them the great horde might tear the earth and muddy the rivers and send up clouds of choking dust, but the fields ahead of them were always green and verdant. They crossed the rolling hills of Norvas, past terraced farms and small villages, where the townsfolk watched anxiously from atop white stucco walls. They forded three wide, placid rivers, and a fourth that was swift and narrow and treacherous, camped beside a high blue waterfall, skirted the tumble ruins of a vast dead city, where ghosts were said to moan among blackened marble columns. They raced down Valerian roads 1,000 years old and straight as a Dothraki arrow. For half a moon they rode through the forest of Cahor, where the leaves made a golden canopy high above them, and the trunks of the trees were as wide as city gates. There were great elk in that wood, and spotted tigers, and lemurs with silver fur and huge purple eyes. But all fled before the approach of the Khalasar, and Danny got no glimpse of them. By then, her agony was a fading memory. She still ached after her long day's riding, yet somehow the pain had a sweetness to it now, and each morning she came willingly to her saddle, eager to know what wonders waited for her in the lands ahead. She began to find pleasure even in her nights, and if she still cried out when Drogo took her, it was not always in pain. At the bottom of the ridge, the grasses rose around her, tall and supple. Danny slowed to a trot and rode out onto the plain, losing herself in the green, blessedly alone. In the Khalasar, she was never alone. Khal Drogo came to her only after the sun went down, but her handmaids fed her and bathed her and slept by the door of her tent. Drogo's blood riders and the men of her cars were never far, and her brother was an unwelcome shadow day and night. Danny could hear him at the top of the ridge, his voice shrill with anger, as he shouted at Ser Jorah. She rode on, submerging herself deeper in the Dothraki Sea. The green swallowed her up. The air was rich with the scents of earth and grass, mixed with the smell of horseflesh and Danny's sweat and the oil in her hair. Dothraki smells. They seem to belong here. Danny breathed it all in, laughing. She had a sudden urge to feel the ground beneath her, to curl her toes in the thick black soil. Swinging down from her saddle, she let the silver graze, while she pulled off her high boots. Viserys came upon her as suddenly as a summer storm, his horse rearing beneath him as he reined up too hard. "You dare!" he screamed at her. "You give commands to me, to me!" He vaulted off his horse, stumbling as he landed. His face was flushed as he struggled back to his feet. He grabbed her, shook her. "Have you forgotten who you are? Look at you! Look at you!" Danny did not need to look. She was barefoot, with oiled hair, wearing Dothraki riding leathers and a painted vest given her as a bride gift. She looked as though she belonged here. Viserys was soiled and stained in city silks and ringmail. He was still screaming, "You do not command the dragon, do you understand? I am the Lord of the Seven Kingdoms. I will not hear orders from some horse lord's slut. Do you hear?" His hand went under her vest, his fingers digging painfully into her breast. "Do you hear me?" Danny shoved him away, hard. Viserys stared at her, his lilac eyes incredulous. She had never defied him, never fought back. Rage twisted his features. He would hurt her now, and badly. She knew that. Crack! The whip made a sound like thunder. The coil took Viserys around the throat and yanked him backward. He went sprawling in the grass, stunned and choking. The Dothraki riders hooted at him as he struggled to free himself. The one with the whip, Yon Jugo, rasped a question. Danny did not understand his words, but by then Irra was there, and Ser Jorah, and the rest of her cars. "Jugo asks if you would have him dead, Khaleesi," Irra said. "No," Danny replied, "no." Jugo understood that. One of the others barked out a comment, and the Dothraki laughed. Irra told her, "Quarrow thinks you should take an ear to teach him respect." Her brother was on his knees, his fingers digging under the leather coils, crying incoherently, struggling for breath. The whip was tight around his windpipe. "Tell them I do not wish him harmed," Danny said. Ira repeated her words in Dothraki. Jogo gave a pull on the whip, yanking Viserys around like a puppet on a string. He went sprawling again. Free from the leather embrace, a thin line of blood under his chin where the whip had cut deep. "I warned him what would happen, my lady," Sir Jorah Mormont said. "I told him to stay on the ridge, as you commanded." "I know you did," Danny replied, watching Viserys. He lay on the ground, sucking in air noisily, red-faced and sobbing. He was a pitiable thing. He'd always been a pitiable thing. Why had she never seen that before? There was a hollow place inside her where her fear had been. "Take his horse," Danny commanded Sir Jorah. Viserys gaped at her. He could not believe what he was hearing, nor could Danny quite believe what she was saying, yet the words came. "Let my brother walk behind us, back to the Khalasar." Among the Dothraki, the man who does not ride was no man at all, the lowest of the low, without honour or pride. "Let everyone see him as he is." "No!" Viserys screamed. He turned to Sir Jorah, pleading in the common tongue with words the horsemen would not understand. "Hit her, Mormont! Hurt her! Your king commands it! Kill these Dothraki dogs and teach her!" The exile knight looked from Danny to her brother, she barefoot, with dirt between her toes and oil in her hair, he with his silks and steel. Danny could see the decision on his face. "He shall walk, Khaleesi," he said. He took her brother's horse in hand while Danny remounted her silver. Viserys gaped at him and sat down in the dirt. He kept his silence, but he would not move, and his eyes were full of poison as they rode away. Soon he was lost in the tall grass. When they could not see him any more, Danny grew afraid. "Will he find his way back?" she asked Sir Jorah as they rode.
"Even a man as blind as your brother should be able to follow our trail," he replied.
"He is proud. He may be too ashamed to come back." Jorah laughed.
"Where else should he go? If he cannot find the Khalasar will most surely find him. It's hard to drown in the Dothraki Sea, child."
Danny saw the truth of that. The Khalasar was like a city on the march, but it did not march blindly. Always scouts ranged far ahead of the main column, alert for any sign of game or prey or enemies, while outriders guarded their flanks. They missed nothing. Not here, in this land, the place where they had come from. These plains were a part of them. And of her, now. "I hit him," she said, wonder in her voice. Now that it was over, it seemed like a strange dream that she had dreamed. "Sir Jorah, do you think—" "He'll be so angry when he gets back," she shivered. "I woke the dragon, didn't I?" Sir Jorah snorted. "Can you wake the dead, girl? Your brother Rhaegar was the last dragon, and he died on the Trident. Viserys is less than the shadow of a snake." His blunt words startled her. It seemed as though all the things she had always believed were suddenly called into question. You swore him your sword.
"That I did, girl," Sir Jorah said. "And if your brother is the shadow of a snake, what does that make his servants?"
His voice was bitter. "He is still the true king. He is." Jorah pulled up his horse and looked at her.
"Truth now, would you want to see Viserys sit a throne?"
Danny thought about it.
"He would not be a very good king, would he?"
"There have been worse, but not many."
The knight gave his heels to his mount and started off again. Danny rode close beside him. "Still," she said, "the common people are waiting for him. Magister Illyrio says they are sewing dragon banners and praying for Viserys to return from across the narrow sea to free them."
"The common people pray for rain, healthy children, and a summer that never ends," Sir Jorah told her. "It's no matter to them if the High Lords play their game of thrones. so long as they're left in peace. He gave a shrug. They never are.
Danny rode along quietly for a time, working his words like a puzzle box. It went against everything that Viserys had ever told her. To think that the people could care so little whether a true king or a usurper reigned over them. Yet the more she thought on Jorah's words, the more they rang of truth. "What do you pray for, Sir Jorah?" she asked him.
"Home," he said. His voice was thick with longing.
"I pray for home, too," she told him, believing it. Sir Jorah laughed.
"Look around you, then, Khaleesi."
But it was not the plains Danny saw then. It was King's Landing and the great red keep that Aegon the Conqueror had built. It was Dragonstone, where she had been born. In her mind's eye, they burned with a thousand lights, a fire blazing in every window. In her mind's eye, all the doors were red. "My brother will never take back the Seven Kingdoms," Danny said. She had known that for a long time, she realized. She had known it all her life. Only she had never let herself say the words, even in a whisper. But now she said them for Jorah Mormont and all the world to hear. Sir Jorah gave her a measuring look.
"You think not?"
"He could not lead an army, even if my lord husband gave him one," Danny said. "He has no coin, and the only knight who follows him reviles him as less than a snake. The Dothraki make mock of his weakness. He will never take us home."
"Wise child," the knight smiled.
"I'm no child," she told him fiercely. Her heels pressed into the sides of her mount, rousing the silver to a gallop. Faster and faster she raced, leaving Jorah and Irra and the others far behind, the warm wind in her hair and the setting sun red on her face. By the time she reached the Khalasar, it was dusk. The slaves had erected her tent by the shore of a spring-fed pool. She could hear rough voices from the woven grass palace on the hill. Soon there would be laughter when the men of her cause told the story of what had happened in the grasses today. By the time Viserys came limping back among them, every man, woman, and child in the camp would know him for a walker. There were no secrets in the Khalasar. Danny gave the silver over to the slaves for grooming and entered her tent. It was cool and dim beneath the silk. As she let the door flap close behind her, Danny saw a finger of dusty red light reach out to touch her dragon's eggs across the tent. For an instant, a thousand droplets of scarlet flame swam before her eyes. She blinked, and they were gone. "Stone," she told herself. "They are only stone. Even Illyrio said so. The dragons are all dead." She put her palm against the black egg. Fingers spread gently across the curve of the shell. The stone was warm, almost hot. "The sun," Danny whispered. "The sun warmed them as they rode." She commanded her handmaidens to prepare her a bath. Doria built a fire outside the tent, while Iri and Jiqui fetched the big copper tub, another bridal gift, from the pack horses and carried water from the pool. When the bath was steaming, Iri helped her into it and climbed in after her. "Have you ever seen a dragon?" she asked, as Iri scrubbed her back and Jiqui sluiced sand from her hair. She had heard that the first dragons had come from the east, from the Shadowlands beyond Ashai and the islands of the Jade Sea. Perhaps some were still living there, in realms strange and wild. "Dragons are gone, Khaleesi," Iri said. "Dead," agreed Jiqui, "long and long ago." Viserys had told her that the last Targaryen dragons had died no more than a century and a half ago, during the reign of Aegon the Third, who was called the Dragonbane. That did not seem so long ago to Danny. "Everywhere," she said, disappointed, "even in the East. Magic had died in the West when the doom fell on Valeria and the lands of the Long Summer, and neither spell-forged steel nor storm-singers nor dragons could hold it back. But Danny had always heard that the East was different. It was said that manacores prowl the islands of the Jade Sea, that basilisks infested the jungles of Yi Ti, that spell-singers, warlocks, and aeromancers practice their arts openly in Ashai, while shadow-binders and blood-mages work terrible sorceries in the black of night. Why shouldn't there be dragons, too?" "No dragon," Eri said. "Brave men kill them, for dragon, terrible evil beasts, it is known." "It is known," agreed Jiqui. "A trader from Karth once told me that dragons came from the moon," Blondaria said as she warmed a towel over the fire. Jiqui and Eri were of an age with Danny, Dothraki girls taken as slaves when Drogo destroyed their father's Khalasar. Doria was older, almost 20. Magister Illyrio had found her in a pleasure house in Lys. Silvery wet hair tumbled over her eyes as Danny turned her head, curious. "The moon?"
"He told me the moon was an egg, Khaleesi," the Lysine girl said. "Once there were two moons in the sky, but one wandered too close to the sun and cracked from the heat. A thousand dragons poured forth and drank the fire of the sun. That is why dragons breathe flame. One day the other moon will kiss the sun too, and then it will crack, and the dragons will return."
The two Dothraki girls giggled and laughed. "You are foolish, straw-haired slave," Eri said. "Moon is no egg. Moon is God. Woman, wife of sun. It is known." "It is known," Jiqui agreed. Danny's skin was flushed and pink when she climbed from the tub. Jiqui laid her down to oil her body and scrape the dirt from her paws. Afterward, Eri sprinkled her with spice flour and cinnamon, while Doria brushed her hair until it shone like spun silver. She thought about the moon and eggs and dragons. Her supper was a simple meal of fruit and cheese and fry bread, with a jug of honeyed wine to wash it down. "Doria, stay and eat with me," Danny commanded when she sent her other handmaids away. The Lysine girl had hair the color of honey and eyes like the summer sky. She lowered those eyes when they were alone. "You honor me, Khaleesi," she said, but it was no honor, only service. Long after the moon had risen, they sat together, talking. That night when Khal Drogo came, Danny was waiting for him. He stood in the door of her tent and looked at her with surprise. She rose slowly and opened her sleeping silks and let them fall to the ground. "This night we must go outside, my lord," she told him, for the Dothraki believed that all things of importance in a man's life must be done beneath the open sky. Khal Drogo followed her out into the moonlight, the bells in his hair tinkling softly. A few yards from her tent was a bed of soft grass, and it was there that Danny drew him down. When he tried to turn her over, she put a hand to his chest. "No," she said, "this night I would look on your face." There is no privacy in the heart of the Khalasar. Danny felt the eyes on her as she undressed him, heard the soft voices as she did the things that Doria had told her to do. It was nothing to her. Was she not Khaleesi? His were the only eyes that mattered, and when she mounted him, she saw something there that she had never seen before. She rode him as fiercely as ever she had ridden her silver, and when the moment of his pleasure came, Khal Drogo called out her name. They were on the far side of the Dothraki Sea, when Jiqui brushed the soft swell of Danny's stomach with her fingers and said, "Khaleesi, you are with child." "I know," Danny told her. It was her 14th name day. Bran. In the yard below, Rickon ran with the wolves. Bran watched him from his window seat. Wherever the boy went, Grey Wind was there first, loping ahead to cut him off, until Rickon saw him, screamed in delight, and went pelting off in another direction. Shaggy Dog ran at his heels, spinning and snapping if the other wolves came too close. His fur had darkened until he was all black, and his eyes were green fire. Bran Summer came last. He was silver and smoke, with eyes of yellow gold that saw all there was to see. Smaller than Grey Wind, and more wary. Bran thought he was the smartest of the litter. He could hear his brother's breathless laughter as Rickon dashed across the hard-packed earth on little baby legs. His eyes stung. He wanted to be down there, laughing and running. Angry at the thought, Bran knuckled away the tears before they could fall. His eighth name day had come and gone. He was almost a man grown now, too old to cry. "It was just a lie," he said bitterly, remembering the crow from his dream. "I can't fly. I can't even run."
"Crows are all liars,"
old Nan agreed, from the chair where she sat doing her needlework.
"I know a story about a crow."
"I don't want any more stories," Bran snapped, his voice petulant. He had liked old Nan and her stories once, before, but it was different now. They left her with him all day now to watch over him and clean him and keep him from being lonely. But she just made it worse. "I hate your stupid stories." The old woman smiled at him toothlessly.
"My stories? No, my little lord, not mine. These stories are before me and after me, before you too."
She was a very ugly old woman, Bran thought spitefully. Shrunken and wrinkled, almost blind, too weak to climb stairs, with only a few wisps of white hair left to cover a mottled pink scalp. No one really knew how old she was, but his father said she had been called Old Nan even when he was a boy. She was the oldest person in Winterfell for certain. Maybe the oldest person in the Seven Kingdoms. Nan had come to the castle as a wet nurse for a Brandon Stark whose mother had died birthing him. He had been an older brother of Lord Rickard, Bran's grandfather, or perhaps a younger brother, or a brother of Lord Rickard's father. Sometimes old Nan told it one way and sometimes another. In all the stories, the little boy died at three of a summer chill. But old Nan stayed on at Winterfell with her own children. She had lost both her sons to the war when King Robert won the throne, and her grandson was killed on the walls of Pyke during Balon Greyjoy's rebellion. Her daughters had long ago married and moved away and died. All that was left of her own blood was Hodor, the simple-minded giant who worked in the stables. But old Nan just lived on and on, doing her needlework and retelling her stories. "I don't care whose stories they are," Bran told her. "I hate them." He didn't want stories, and he didn't want old Nan. He wanted his mother and father. He wanted to go running with Summer loping beside him. He wanted to climb the broken tower and feed corn to the crows. He wanted to ride his pony again with his brothers. He wanted it to be the way it had been before.
"I know a story about a boy who hated stories," old Nan said with her stupid little smile, her needles moving all the while, click, 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 until Bran was ready to scream at her.
It would never be the way it had been, he knew. The crow had tricked him into flying, but when he woke up, he was broken, and the world was changed. They had all left him, his father and his mother and his sisters, and even his bastard brother John. His father had promised he would ride a real horse to King's Landing, but they'd gone without him. Maester Lewin had sent a bird off to Lord Eddard with a message and another to Mother and a third to John on the wall, but there had been no answers.
"Oft times the birds are lost, child," the maester had told him. "There's many a mile and many a hawk between here and King's Landing. The message may not have reached them."
Yet to Bran it felt as if they had all died while he had slept, or perhaps Bran had died, and they had forgotten him. Jorri and Ser Roddick and Vaean Pool had gone too, and Hullan and Harwin and Fat Tom, and a quarter of the guard. Only Rob and Baby Rickon were still here, and Rob was changed. He was Rob the Lord now, or trying to be. He wore a real sword and never smiled. His days were spent drilling the guard and practicing his sword play, making the yard ring with the sound of steel as Bran watched forlornly from his window. At night he closeted himself with Maester Lewin, talking or going over account books. Sometimes he would ride out with Hallis Mollen, and be gone for days at a time, visiting distant holdfasts. Whenever he was away more than a day, Rickon would cry and ask Bran if Rob was ever coming back. Even when he was home at Winterfell, Rob the Lord seemed to have more time for Hallis Mollen and Theon Greyjoy than he ever did for his brothers.
"I could tell you a story about Brandon the Builder," old Ned said. "That was always your favourite."
Thousands and thousands of years ago, Brandon the Builder had razed Winterfell, and some said the Wall. Bran knew the story, but it had never been his favourite. Maybe one of the other Brandons had liked that story. Sometimes Nan would talk to him as if he were her Brandon, the baby she had nursed all those years ago, and sometimes she confused him with his uncle Brandon, who was killed by the Mad King before Bran was even born. She had lived so long, Mother had told him once, that all the Brandon Starks had become one person in her head. "That's not my favourite," he said. "My favourites were the scary ones." He heard some sort of commotion outside and turned back to the window. Rickon was running across the yard toward the gatehouse, the wolves following him. But the tower faced the wrong way for Bran to see what was happening. He smashed a fist on his thigh in frustration and felt nothing.
"Oh, my sweet summer child," old Nan said quietly, "what do you know of fear? Fear is for the winter, my little lord, when the snows fall 100 feet deep and the ice wind comes howling out of the north. Fear is for the long night, when the sun hides its face for years at a time, and little children are born and live and die all in darkness, while the dire wolves grow gaunt and hungry, and the white walkers move through the woods."
"You mean the others?" Bran said querulously.
"The others?" old Nan agreed. "Thousands and thousands of years ago, a winter fell that was cold and hard and endless beyond all memory of man. There came a night that lasted a generation, and kings shivered and died in their castles, even as the swineherds in their hovels. Women smothered their children rather than see them starve, and cried, and felt their tears freeze on their cheeks."
Her voice and her needles fell silent, and she glanced up at Bran with pale, filmy eyes and asked,
"So, child, this is the sort of story you like?"
"Well," Bran said reluctantly, "yes, only..." Old Nan nodded.
"In that darkness, the others came for the first time,"
she said as her needles went click,
click, click.
They were cold things, dead things, that hated iron and fire and the touch of the sun and every creature with hot blood in its veins. They swept over whole forests and cities and kingdoms, felled heroes and armies by the score, riding their pale dead horses and leading hosts of the slain. All the swords of men could not stay their advance, and even maidens and suckling babies found no pity in them. They hunted the maids through frozen forests and fed their dead servants on the flesh of human children.
A voice had dropped very low, almost to a whisper, and Bran found himself leaning forward to listen.
Now these were the days before the Andals came, and long before the women fled across the narrow sea from the cities of the Roin and the hundred kingdoms of those times were the kingdoms of the first men who had taken these lands from the children of the forest. Yet here and there, in the vastness of the woods, the children still lived in their wooden cities and hollow hills, and the faces in the trees kept watch. So as cold and death filled the earth, the last hero determined to seek out the children, in the hopes that their ancient magics could win back what the armies of men had lost. He set out into the dead lands with a sword, a horse, a dog, and a dozen companions. For years he searched, until he despaired of ever finding the children of the forest in their secret cities. One by one his friends died, and his horse, and finally even his dog, and his sword froze so hard the blade snapped when he tried to use it. And the other smelled the hot blood in him and came silent on his trail, stalking him with packs of pale white spiders, big as hounds.
The door opened with a bang, and Bran's heart leapt up into his mouth in sudden fear. But it was only Maester Lewin, with Hodor looming on the stairway behind him. "Hodor," the stable boy announced, as was his custom, smiling hugely at them all. Maester Lewin was not smiling.
"We have visitors," he announced, "and your presence is required, Bran."
"I'm listening to a story now," Bran complained.
"Stories wait, my little lord, and when you come back to them, why, there they are,"
old Nan said.
"Visitors are not so patient, and oft-times they bring stories of their own."
"Who is it?" Bran asked Maester Lewin.
"Tyrion Lannister and some men of the Night's Watch with a word from your brother John. Rob is meeting with them now. Hoda, will you help Bran down the hall?"
"Hodor,"
Hodor agreed happily. He ducked to get his great shaggy head under the door. Hodor was nearly 7 feet tall. It was hard to believe that he was the same blood as old Nan. Bran wondered if he would shrivel up as small as his great-grandmother when he was old. It did not seem likely, even if Hodor lived to be 1,000. Hodor lifted Bran as easily as if he were a bale of hay and cradled him against his massive chest. He always smelled faintly of horses, and it was not a bad smell. His arms were thick with muscle and matted with brown hair. "Hodor," he said again. Theon Greyjoy had once commented that Hodor did not know much, but no one could doubt that he knew his name. Old Nan had cackled like a hen when Bran told her that, and confessed that Hodor's real name was Walder. No one knew where Hodor had come from, she said,
but when he started saying it, they started calling him by it. It was the only word he had. They left old Nan in the tower room with her needles and her memories. Hodor hummed tunelessly as he carried Bran down the steps and through the gallery, with Maester Lewin following behind, hurrying to keep up with the stable boy's long strides. Rob was seated in Father's high seat, wearing ringmail and boiled leather, and the stern face of Rob the Lord. Theon Greyjoy and Halas Mollan stood behind him. A dozen guardsmen lined the grey stone walls beneath tall, narrow windows. In the centre of the room the dwarf stood with his servants, and four strangers in the black of the night's watch. Bran could sense the anger in the hall at the moment Hodor carried him through the doors. "Any man of the night's watch is welcome here at Winterfell for as long as he wishes to stay," Rob was saying with the voice of Rob the Lord. His sword was across his knees, the steel bare for all the world to see. Even Bran knew what it meant to greet a guest with an unsheathed sword. "Any man of the night's watch," the dwarf repeated, "but not me. Do I take your meaning, boy?" Rob stood and pointed at the little man with his sword. "I am the Lord while my mother and father are away, Lannister. I am not your boy."
"If you are a lord, you might learn a lord's courtesy," the little man replied, ignoring the sword point in his face. "Your bastard brother has all your father's graces, it would seem."
"John!" Bran gasped out from Hodor's arms. The dwarf turned to look at him.
"So it is true, the boy lives. I could scarce believe it. You Starks are hard to kill."
"You Lannister had best remember that," Rob said, lowering his sword. "Hodor, bring my brother here."
"Hodor!"
Hodor said, as he trotted forward smiling, and set Bran in the high seat of the Starks, where the lords of Winterfell had sat since the days when they called themselves the Kings of the North. The seat was cold stone, polished smooth by countless bottoms. The carved heads of direwolves snarled on the ends of its massive arms. Bran clasped them as he sat, his useless legs dangling. The great seat made him feel half a baby. Rob put a hand on his shoulder. "You said you had business with Bran. Well, here he is, Lannister." Bran was uncomfortably aware of Tyrion Lannister's eyes. One was black and one was green, and both were looking at him, studying him, weighing him.
"I am told you are quite a climber, Bran," the little man said at last. "Tell me, how is it you happened to fall that day?"
"I never," Bran insisted. "He never fell. Never, never, never."
"The child does not remember anything of the fall or the climb that came before it," said Maester Lewin gently. "Curious," said Tyrion Lannister.
"My brother is not here to answer questions, Lannister," Rob said curtly. "Do your business. Be on your way."
"I have a gift for you," the dwarf said to Bran. "Do you like to ride, boy?"
Maester Lewin came forward.
"My lord, the child has lost the use of his legs. He cannot sit a horse."
"Nonsense," said Lannister.
"With the right horse and the right saddle, even a cripple can ride."
The word was a knife through Bran's heart. He felt tears come unbidden to his eyes.
"I'm not a cripple."
"Then I am not a dwarf," the dwarf said with a twist of his mouth.
"My father will rejoice to hear it."
Greyjoy laughed.
"What sort of horse and saddle are you suggesting?" Maester Lewin said. "A smart horse," Lannister replied. "The boy cannot use his legs to command the animal, so you must shape the horse to the rider. Teach it to respond to the reins, to the voice. I would begin with an unbroken yearling, with no old training to be unlearned."
He drew a roll of paper from his belt.
"Give this to your saddler. He will provide the rest."
Maester Lewin took the paper from the dwarf's hand, curious, as a small grey squirrel. He unrolled it, studied it. I see. You draw nicely, my lord. Yes, this ought to work. I should have thought of this myself. It came easier to me, maester. It's not terribly unlike my own saddles.
Will I truly be able to ride? Bran asked. He wanted to believe them, but he was afraid. Perhaps it was just another lie. The crow had promised him that he could fly.
You will, the dwarf told him, and I swear to you, boy, on horseback, you will be as tall as any of them.
Robb Stark seemed puzzled. Is this some trap, Lannister? What's Bran to you? Why should you want to help him?
Your brother John has asked it of me, and I have a tender spot in my heart for cripples and bastards and broken things.
Tyrion Lannister placed a hand over his heart and grinned. The door to the yard flew open. Sunlight came streaming across the hall as Rickon burst in, breathless. The direwolves were with him. The boy stopped by the door, wide-eyed, but the wolves came on. Their eyes found Lannister, or perhaps they caught his scent. Summer began to growl first. Grey wind picked it up. They padded towards the little man, one from the right and one from the left.
"The wolves do not like your smell, Lannister,"
Theon Greyjoy commented.
"Perhaps it's time I took my leave," Tyrion said.
He took a step backward, and Shaggy Dog came out of the shadows behind him, snarling. Lannister recoiled, and Summer lunged at him from the other side. He reeled away, unsteady on his feet, and Greywind snapped at his arm, teeth ripping at his sleeve and tearing loose a scrap of cloth. "No!" Bran shouted from the high seat, as Lannister's men reached for their steel. "Summer, here! Summer, to me!" The direwolf heard the voice, glanced at Bran, and again at Lannister. He crept backwards, away from the little man, and settled down below Bran's dangling feet. Robb had been holding his breath. He let it out with a sigh and called, "Greywind!" His direwolf moved to him, swift and silent. Now there was only Shaggy Dog, rumbling at the small man, his eyes burning like green fire. "Rickon, call him!" Bran shouted to his baby brother, and Rickon remembered himself and screamed, "Home, Shaggy Dog, home now!" The Black Wolf gave Lannister one final snarl and bounded off to Rickon, who hugged him tightly around the neck. Tyrion Lannister undid his scarf, mopped his brow, and said in a flat tone,
"How interesting."
"Are you well, my lord?" asked one of the men, his sword in hand. He glanced nervously at the direwolves as he spoke.
My sleeve is torn, and my breeches are unaccountably damp. But nothing was harmed, save my dignity."
Even Robb looked shaken.
"The wolves, I don't know why they did that."
"No doubt they mistook me for dinner."
Lannister bowed stiffly to Bran.
"I thank you for calling them off, young sir. I promise you they would have found me quite indigestible. And now I will be leaving, truly."
A moment, my lord," Maester Lewin said. He moved to Robb, and they huddled close together, whispering. Bran tried to hear what they were saying, but their voices were too low. Robb Stark finally sheathed his sword.
I may have been hasty with you," he said. "You've done Bran a kindness, and, well..."
Robb composed himself with an effort.
"The hospitality of Winterfell is yours, if you wish it, Lannister."
"Spare me your false courtesies, boy. You do not love me, and you do not want me here. I saw an inn outside your walls, in the winter town. I'll find a bed there, and both of us will sleep easier. For a few coppers, I may even find a comely wench to warm the sheets for me."
He spoke to one of the Black Brothers, an old man with a twisted back and a tangled beard.
"Yarren we go south at daybreak. You will find me on the road, no doubt."
With that he made his exit, struggling across the hall on his short legs, past Rickon, and out of the door. His men followed. The four of the night's watch remained. Robb turned to them uncertainly.
"I've had rooms prepared, and you'll find no lack of hot water,
to wash off the dust of the road. I hope you will honour us at table tonight." He spoke the words so awkwardly that even Bran took note. It was a speech he had learned, not words from the heart, but the Black Brothers thanked him all the same. Summer followed them up the tower steps as Hodor carried Bran back to his bed. Old Nan was asleep in her chair. Hodor said, "Hodor," gathered up his great-grandmother and carried her off, snoring softly while Bran lay thinking. Rob had promised that he could feast for the night's watch in the great hall. "Summer," he called. The wolf bounded up to the bed. Bran hugged him so hard he could feel the hot breath on his cheek. "I can ride now," he whispered to his friend. "We can go hunting in the woods soon. Wait and see." After a time, he slept. In his dream, he was climbing again, pulling himself up an ancient windowless tower, his fingers forcing themselves between blackened stones, his feet scrabbling for purchase. Higher and higher he climbed, through the clouds and into the night sky, and still the tower rose before him. When he paused to look down, his head swam dizzily, and he felt his fingers slipping. Bran cried out and clung for dear life. The earth was 1,000 miles beneath him, and he could not fly. He could not fly. He waited until his heart had stopped pounding, until he could breathe, and he began to climb again. There was no way to go but up. Far above him, outlined against a vast pale moon, he thought he could see the shapes of gargoyles. His arms were sore and aching, but he dare not rest. He forced himself to climb faster. The gargoyles watched him ascend. Their eyes glowed red as hot coals in a brazier. Perhaps once they had been lions, but now they were twisted and grotesque. Bran could hear them whispering to each other in soft stone voices terrible to hear. He must not listen, he told himself. He must not hear. So long as he did not hear them, he was safe. But when the gargoyles pulled themselves loose from the stone and padded down the side of the tower to where Bran clung, he knew he was not safe after all. "I didn't hear," he wept as they came closer and closer. "I didn't! I didn't!" He woke, gasping, lost in darkness, and saw a vast shadow looming over him. "I didn't hear," he whispered, trembling in fear. And then the shadow said, "Hodor," and lit the candle by the bedside, and Bran sighed with relief. Hodor washed the sweat from him with a warm, damp cloth, and dressed him with deft and gentle hands. When it was time, he carried him down to the great hall, where a long trestle table had been set up near the fire. The lord's seat at the head of the table had been left empty, but Rob sat to the right of it, with Bran across from him. They ate suckling pig that night, and pigeon pie, and turnip soaked in butter, and afterwards the cook had promised honeycombs. Summer snatched table scraps from Bran's hand, while Grey Wind and Shaggy Dog fought over a bone in the corner. Winterfell's dogs would not come near the hall now. Bran had found that strange at first, but he was growing used to it. Yoren was senior among the Black Brothers, so the steward had seated him between Rob and Maester Lewin. The old man had a sour smell, as if he had not washed in a long time. He ripped at the meat with his teeth, cracked the ribs to suck out the marrow from the bones, and shrugged at the mention of Jon Snow. "Sir Alistair's bane," he grunted, and two of his companions shared a laugh that Bran did not understand. But when Rob asked for news of their Uncle Benjen, the Black Brothers grew ominously quiet. "What is it?" Bran asked. Yoren wiped his fingers on his vest.
"There's hard news, me lords, and a cruel way to pay you for your meat and mead. But the man as asked the question must bear the answer. Stark's gone."
One of the other men said,
"The old bearer sent him out to look for Wainor Royce,
and his late returning, my lord.
Too long,
Yoren said.
Most like he's dead.
My uncle is not dead, Robb Stark said loudly, anger in his tones. He rose from the bench and laid his hand on the hilt of his sword. Do you hear me? My uncle is not dead. His voice rang against the stone walls, and Bran was suddenly afraid. Old sour-smelling Yoren looked up at Robb, unimpressed.
"Whatever you say, my lord,"
he said. He sucked at a piece of meat between his teeth. The youngest of the Black Brothers shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
"There's not a man on the wall knows the Haunted Forest better than Benjen Stark. He'll find his way back."
"Well," said Yoren, "maybe he will, and maybe he won't. Good men have gone into those woods before and never come out."
All Bran could think of was old Nan's stories of the others, and the last hero, hounded through the white woods by dead men and spiders as big as hounds. He was afraid for a moment, until he remembered how the story ended. "The children will help him," he blurted. "The children of the forest." Theon Greyjoy sniggered, and Maester Luwin said,
"Bran, the children of the forest have been dead and gone for thousands of years. All that is left of them are the faces in the trees."
"Down here, might be that's true, maester," Yoren said. "But up past the wall, who's to say? Up there, a man can't always tell what's alive and what's dead."
That night, after the plates had been cleared, Robb carried Bran up to bed himself. Grey Wind led the way, and Summer came close behind. His brother was strong for his age, and Bran was as light as a bundle of rags. But the stairs were steep and dark, and Robb was breathing hard by the time they reached the top. He put Bran into bed, covered him with blankets, and blew out the candle. For a time, Robb sat beside him in the dark. Bran wanted to talk to him, but he did not know what to say. "We'll find a horse for you. I promise," Robb whispered at last. "Are they ever coming back?" Bran asked him. "Yes," Robb said, with such hope in his voice that Bran knew he was hearing his brother and not just Robb the Lord. "Mother will be home soon. Maybe we can ride out to meet her when she comes. Wouldn't that surprise her to see you a horse?" Even in the dark room, Bran could feel his brother smile. "And afterwards, we'll ride north to see the war. We won't even tell John we're coming. We'll just be there one day, you and me. It will be an adventure." "An adventure," Bran repeated wistfully. He heard his brother sob. The room was so dark he could not see the tears on Rob's face. So he reached out and found his hand, their fingers twined together. Eddard.
"Lord Aaron's death was a great sadness for all of us, my lord," Grandmaster Pycelle said. I would be more than happy to tell you what I can of the manner of his passing. Do be seated. Would you care for refreshments? Some dates, perhaps? I have some very fine persimmons as well. Wine no longer agrees with my digestion, I fear. But I can offer you a cup of iced milk, sweetened with honey. I find it most refreshing in this heat."
There was no denying the heat. Ned could feel the silk tunic clinging to his chest. Thick, moist air covered the city like a damp woolen blanket, and the riverside had grown unruly as the poor fled their hot, airless warrens to jostle for sleeping places near the water, where the only breath of wind was to be found. "That would be most kind," Ned said, seating himself. Pycelle lifted a tiny silver bell with thumb and forefinger and tinkled it gently. A slender young serving girl hurried into the solar.
"Iced milk for the king's hand and myself, if you will be so kind, child. Well sweetened."
As the girl went to fetch their drinks, the Grand Maester knotted his fingers together, and rested his hands on his stomach.
"The small folk say that the last year of summer is always the hottest. It is not so, yet oftentimes it feels that way.